Good morning. So how'd the assignment go? I know several of you asked for extensions, but not as many as the week before. So at least when I last checked my mail at like 10:45, if you send in one after that, I might not have given you an extension. But Anyway, comments, questions? You get to the last question? How was that? Yeah, the logging one. Well, the funny thing about it is you're supposed to create a file at the top level that was inside the file system that was producing the logs. That was a little bit of the tricky part because you actually had to understand what it took to actually add a file system to it. But of course, it was all there in the code because you just do the lookup and open. You just do it within the init function. There's different ways to do it, but yeah. Perfect. Exactly. That's exactly what you're supposed to do. Oh, you mean oh, I see the owner of this stuff. Well, yeah, I know what you mean. I think what you could have done is look up what the ID of the process was, or what the access of what that was, the context of what. So you'd have to do it just as the process that was running the thing. But the fact is that you actually can't, when it's being run as a non-privileged user, you can't create files other than that user anyway. So if you started a student, you'd only create files owned by student. So, because the kernel's still implementing restrictions. Okay, so yes?
I was just going to say, I had a little bit of problem with read-write errors. I couldn't read the log file from the shell afterwards. And I thought it might have had something to do with not understanding what there's quite a few structs that are being used that I'm not sure I understood fully.
That's very possible if you're getting an IO error. You shouldn't have gotten an IO error doing it, but.
It didn't give me any. Didn't give any problems eventually creating the log file and writing to it.
Like one thing you could have done to figure out how, like, what you could have done is use the program as it was, created a file, and just added code to, or use a debugger to dump the data structures and to see what a regular text file looked like in there. And you could have just duplicated that. But you could have just, gone to the shell and created a text file that was called log, and then just see what it had added to its data structures, and then just add that manually when the program starts up. That would have been. Most of that is actually static. So you'll see the solutions. You'll see how it is. We can talk about this more. So we only have there's this lecture. And there's next week. And that's it, right? Well, next week I'll keep talking about, well, I think I'll be talking about probably the solutions for all the assignments. Right, that'll be a big part of next week. But I do want to, I'm not going to probably be covering much new material, but it will probably might be new to you all when I connect the pieces together in different ways. So, yes?
Do you have any review?
So I can have a review. So that's a good question. I was thinking of having a review session on December 12th. That's the Friday. Is that if, what? You have two exams on December 12th? I'm out of town the 11th. I could do it on the 10th. Aren't there classes on the 10th though?
Yeah.
Eighth is last day? I could do it on the 10th. Do people want it earlier?
Yeah.
Earlier? So.
Earlier.
I'm going over material and lecture next week. So it's really up to you all when subject to my scheduling constraints, of course. But let's see. So there's next week, the 5th, 6th, 7th. Okay, we could even do it on, well, we could do it on Monday even, but, I mean, yeah, I could do it easily. I could do it Tuesday or Wednesday, the 9th. Okay, the folks who are here get to vote. You didn't show up, sorry. So I'm assuming afternoon is better, correct? Yeah, I could do it at 8:30 in the morning.
You could, but yeah.
So like 1 p.m. On Tuesday or Wednesday?
Wednesday.
No, this is the 9th or 10th. How many of you want 9th? December 9th at 1 p.m. That's the Tuesday. Tuesday at 1 p.m. How many of you want it at Wednesday, 1 p.m.? Okay, it's fewer. How many of you have hard conflicts on Tuesday? Okay, what are your hard conflicts? What's on? Oh, you got work. Okay, just. Okay, do some of you have projects?
I have classes at project one.
How can you have classes on the 10th? What? Yeah, there's no classes.
Just make it Wednesday.
So Wednesday people have, who has hard conflicts on Tuesday? You have hard on Tuesday. Who has hard conflicts on Wednesday? Oh, okay. I can record it. The study session does that. I'm just trying to figure. I mean, it's gonna be hard to find a time that works for everyone, especially if you all are working. That's kind of like, what I'll do is I will put up a, it sounds like I should probably do a poll, and I can put a couple of times and just see what everyone, okay. Yeah, but I can't do the board stuff, you can't see it, so it's, some of the people who haven't showed up to lecture, it might be nice if they actually show up to the study session. Okay, so we'll do a study session on the 9th or 10th. That's interesting. I kind of assume people would want to do it on the 12th. But, and then now we will, let's talk more about
file systems.
So I ended the lecture saying I was going to talk about something today. What did I say? Right, but what was the last thing I said something specifically I thought I was going to talk about this time? Because it was about... I was talking about symbolic links and hard links and why symbolic links are useful when you have multiple file systems. We're talking about latency, talking about bandwidth. We're talking about, errors. Caching.
Yeah.
I don't think I've talked much about caching. Right. So when you do network file systems, if you want to, you have this problem that the network is always going to incur some latency, over having a local copy. So in order to maximize speed and maximize server efficiency, so you don't have to have every file access go to the server, that means you're incurring the round trip time and consuming the server's resources, we do caching. on the client. Most network file systems in some way or the other do client-side caching. Client-side caching makes the semantics of network file systems weird because now you have multiple copies of the file. Every client that accesses a given file logically has either a partial or a full copy of the file. When they make a change, what does everyone else see? Well, so the issue of this is consistency. And in particular, what we're really talking about is cache consistency. Now, cache consistency is a big issue in multiprocessor systems. We have multi-core. How do you make sure all the cores have the same view of main memory? The key thing with symmetric multiprocessing is that all the cores should have the same view of memory. But in fact, on modern systems, it's pretty close to consistent, but it's not completely consistent in the normal case because that would slow things down. If you want to make sure things are consistent, you have to do things, special things like using special locking instructions, swap instructions we talked about earlier. So this is the question now, is you have the cache consistency problem, but now we have no shared memory. So this is a distributed cache. It's a cache distributed logically between every client. And there's also potentially a cache copy of the server, but that's kind of more of an easy case. We have clients 1, 2, 3, 4. We have our server here. Each of these will have their own cached version. So if 1 does a write to the file F, and 2, 3, 4 want to access it, what version do they get? I mean, the only way they can have it is somehow it's communicated to them that, oh, F has changed. So if they have an old copy, they have to throw away their copy of that or update it to the new one. They have to know about this. So there are multiple strategies for doing this, but remember, if you do this in a bad way, you kill performance. Because how do you know? Most of the time, you're not going to be accessing the same file. Well, actually, I take that back. Depends on the design of the system. Some systems, the different ones will be accessing the same file all the time. In fact, sometimes on big distributed file systems, sometimes the common case is everyone accessing one file, such as think of a web index. Logically, you're indexing the entire web. You're writing that to one big web index, then you can have thousands of computers accessing the same file. But in this case, we just looked at a smaller case. But what's the basic strategy? If you want it to have a consistent view, you either have to have F send things to here. And then the server would have to say, okay, send a message to everyone saying, hey, update your copy. Or you could have it so that whenever they access their file, they always check in with the server. And then the server says, oh, well, did you maybe have this? And then it updates me. The ways you can design these protocols are numerous. Well, the question is, when do you sync? How often do you sync? So the normal way you would do this, if you wanted to maintain consistent access, is the file system typically is designed to allow it things to be inconsistent unless you force consistency, just like with main memory. So if we're going to force consistency at specific points and otherwise let things go asynchronously in parallel, what do we call such a mechanism?
you lock it.
Very simple. When one node wants to access the file, it locks it. And the other ones, if they now try to access it, they have to deal with the lock. They say, oh, you can't access it. That if you have that kind of lock. I mean, basically, it might be that the file is locked for writing, but it's still accessible for reading.
So on Windows systems, have you noticed how when you install an update, you basically almost always have to reboot? And in fact, if you install a program and it kind of does some sort of update or something, Windows will say, I can't complete the update because files are in use. Have you ever seen these messages about files are in use because you know you can't do it? So what it mean? What does that mean? What that means is that Windows with NTFS by default locks files for exclusive access every time you access it. Well, sorry, I take that back. Doesn't necessarily lock files for exclusive access, because of course files can be shared, but it locks the files so that they can't be changed underneath it. So you basically, that's why you can't do updates. Like if there's any shared libraries that are being used by a current process, you can't write to it. It's locked. It's got they are being exclusively accessed by those. You cannot change those files until you kill their corresponding processes. And what's the easiest way to make sure all the processes are terminated so that no one's accessing those files? To reboot the system. Now, you might be able to do it by selectively restarting certain processes or something, but that's it. Now, Unix systems don't do this. So they actually are very good for doing in-place updates. What's the difference? There's a file system difference that relates to this that we talked about earlier. Windows doesn't assume that file systems have inodes. So think about that for a second. Windows does not assume that file systems have inodes. Unix systems have, assume inodes. That's what standard POSIX semantics require. Windows does not, because the old FAT file system didn't have inodes. NTFS basically does, but the old FAT file system doesn't. And so what it means is directory entries don't point to an inode. The directory entries point directly to the data blocks. So you can't do things. So what does this mean? You can't do things like hard links. You can't have two file names refer to the same data on disk and both be first-class things. When you delete a file in a system like that, it really deletes the file. But what does that have to do with exclusive access? So what happens to a file when you unlink it? So there is no delete operation in Unix. There is no such thing as delete. The only thing you can do is remove the directory entry for a file. When you remove the directory entry for a file, it decreases the link count of the associated inode by 1. When the inode count gets to 0, the link count gets 0, then the file system knows that the data is no longer being used and it can be reclaimed and used for other files. Well, it's not normally we're talking about files. But directories also work this way. The link count has to be removed to 0. But it has to have special cases because of those other pointers. Let me see if I can clarify. So you have a process P. Okay? We have process P, and it wants to And it's accessing this file F. So P. Now, but what is PF actually? When we say P is accessing F, actually there is, let's say it's slash home slash student slash F. So there's, you know, an inode that has that. You know, and then it points to the some inode. 4, 2, 3. And so when you open the file, what you're actually doing is it looks it up in the directory, says, what inode am I referring to? And then the open file is essentially a pointer directly to the inode. And its reference link goes up. It basically, so before, if this file had a link count of 1, because there was only one file name, which is most files have link counts of 1, the moment you open it, the link count is now 2. What happens now if another process goes and unlinks the file, unlinks F? That goes away. Link count is still 1. It can still access this. So what does this mean for updates? So all you do in a Unix system to update libraries and things is you just unlink the libraries and install new ones. So what you normally would do is you would unpack the package in some temporary directory. It would make new directories, and then you would move them to their destination after having unlinked the existing ones there. So once you move it in place, it has the same name as the old file. I'll turn sorry. So once you unlink the file, it's still in, this unlink process. So let's say this is a library that was needed. Doing this unlink, it still can be accessed by the other processes that had it. But now I've got it, this one now is gone, and now I have a new, this would look like really is now this is pointing to. In any new process coming along, if it wants to access F, it'll get this inode. It gets the new version. So all you have to do to get a process to access a new version is just restart it. But you don't have to restart the process. It's going to keep it's going to keep working fine because it still has access to the old files. They're still there on disk. So I'm giving you as an explanation for why Unix-like systems like Linux, you can do in-place upgrades much more easily. It's because the old files can be kept around in parallel with the new files, because the old file will get the old inode as long as they're being accessed, and then when you open the new, and then the new ones will see the new one. You can't do this on Windows. Windows, this is, instead of this being here, there's no I. This is essentially a hard connection here, and this is going to refer to this. And this is going to be the pointer to the actual data blocks instead of this indirect inode. So what Windows does then is it locks this when there's access to this, and you cannot change this as long as it's being accessed. Because if you could change it, it would mess all this up. It would corrupt a running process. And they don't want you to corrupt a running process. That's why when you have a Windows box, you have to reboot it every time when you want to update files. Simple design decision, big implication. So I'm talking about this in the context of cache consistency and locks in a network file system, because these kind of semantics matter, and they have to carry over to the case when you go to a network file system. And they don't. So you fake it. For example, how can you keep around? So if in a network file system, we never actually open a file by having direct access to its inode. You're instead, you have to have access to the name. But Unix file semantics require you to have access directly to the inode. So most of the time, you can treat them as the same thing, except when an inode gets unlinked. Do you know what a classic way for a network file system to deal with this? What NFS does? It creates a new file name. If you unlink a file and it's still being used, it creates a new name for that file, .nfs27512 or something. And it has that name as long as the file is open. And then it goes away once the process dies and the file gets closed and it says, oh, that. Or sometimes it gets left around if it doesn't clean up properly or something. But so I don't necessarily care about you knowing that specific thing. What I am trying to get you to understand is that when you go into a network, you can't simulate local file system semantics perfectly. It's close. It works much of the time, but it breaks in really weird ways. NFS and AFS are two things part of the textbook. I don't want to go into details completely about their design, but I'm going to talk a little briefly about them because there's one key idea in here that I think is very useful for you to understand, which is stateful versus stateless servers. And it all comes down to this picture right here and the locks we're talking about. If the server, if you're going to have locks, what that really means is that this is it's essentially a callback. Say, S says, okay, one is open. Okay, now 2, 3, and 4, they also have it open. I now need to be able to, the server has to notify. If one of them makes any changes, it has to tell all the rest that that file is changed. How does the server know it? The only way for it to know to tell them, the only way for it to push information back out to the clients is for it to know who has the file open. So the key idea of having locking semantic work is you need the server to be stateful, which means it has to remember the state of the client. It has to know what files are open and by who. But do you want servers to be stateful? The more stateful your server is, the less scalable it is in general. Because now you have to, now the server has to scale with the number of clients in terms of remembering. Depends on your design. There's a lot of trade-offs. But what you'll find is that the really scalable systems all start off as being stateless. And then they add in state where they have to. And they do their best to minimize it. So what does this mean? So NFS, in its original incarnation, version 1, version 2 of NFS. So NFS v2, stateless. So if it's stateless, does it allow for file locking? Not really well. Technically speaking, there's a locking daemon that was there, and then you could register it with the locks and things, but it's not very good. So is it very good for concurrent access to the same files across different, you know, things? Not so much. Although NFS v2 normally did not do much caching of writes. So the things would normally be sent to the server, and clients had limited ability to cache things. If you have more state on the server, the clients can actually do more caching. But NFS v2 was really not with stateless. Is the file API, does it assume state, or is it stateless with respect to access to files? What are the, when I say the file API, what is it? Open, read, write, seek, close. The main one. I'm not talking about the metadata and stuff like that. Let's say the main thing. Those operations. Read depends on the state of seek. Exactly. You seek in a file. You always read at the current position. You seek to change the current position. When you open the file, you're telling the kernel to remember that, oh, I'm accessing this file. Close says, oh, you can forget. I'm done using this file. The file system API is fundamentally stateful. You're telling the kernel, I'm going to use this. And then you're telling it, I'm done using it. Its entire design, its entire optimization is stateful. It makes sense in a local file context to go ahead and make it stateful because you want to do, well, it's to enable caching. I just said NFS v2 is stateless. Yet it is supposed to provide a file system. It's supposed to be a remote file system, network file system, which means it's supposed to provide a file system API. What happened? They had to mangle it. How do you think they mangled it? No. We're talking about the API. We're talking about when a process does a read or does a write or does a seek, it's using the same thing locally. But when it goes over the wire, it gets changed into something else. It gets changed into a stateless protocol. What does it mean for the protocol to be stateless? It means the server has no idea what files are open and closed. It can maybe try to guess it, but fundamentally, every request of the server is independent. Now, this has a really nice design characteristic because it means what happened? Does your server have to remember anything? No. So it does, that means it can save RAM. It has lots and lots of clients. What happens when the server reboots? Does it have to remember what state the clients were in? No. There's nothing to remember. It just reboots. Very nice. Yes. There is no, when you do a seek in NFS v2, the seek doesn't go to the server. The server doesn't know about seeks. The server doesn't know, it's a no-op. Because all the seek does is the local kernel has to say, oh, you've changed the file position. On every read and write, you send the file position. You send the offset in the file at which you wish to do the operation. Offsets have to always be transmitted. And then, what does open and close do? Open just translates the file name to some sort of opaque handle. It says, oh, okay, when you want to, you know, you want to access that path, give me number 57213 or something. No, it's just, that's all it is. It's essentially a lookup call. And then that's it. It has a lookup. Open doesn't do anything else. Close is a no-op. There's nothing to close. So it's still a file system API. It's just mangled on the wire. Entire classes of operations go away, and additional arguments show up for other ones. The kernel has to translate this. Now you see all this, so when you're seeing fuse, you're seeing this exposed API here.
of open read write seek close plus the metadata operations. So if you were to implement as a fuse file system talking to something like NFS, you have to take this into account. You have to, in effect, provide some of the state that normally would be provided by this file system, provide it locally, and then just use that to write, send the right commands. Now, with NFS v3 and NFS v4, the current, what is it, NFS v4.1 or something? The current versions of NFS, they gave up on this. They said, forget it. What they did instead is now the server does maintain state. Why do you think they did that? Again, just looking forward to talking about. Well, it's caching.
Yeah, syncing. You want to be able to sync up the state. You want to be able to lock files. You want to be able to maintain consistency. To do all those things, you need the server to remember things. Does it make the server more heavyweight? Yes. It turns out when NFS was developed, this was actually back in the 80s, when RAM was relatively expensive. So maintaining extra memory for keeping track of all the clients was expensive. RAM is relatively cheap now, so who cares? If you're going to bottleneck on something, you're not going to probably bottleneck on RAM. So stateful servers are much cheaper. For those of you who took my web class, that's the next point might be seeing review, but if you look at HTTP as a protocol, HTTP has two main operations. Well, get and post. Post is essentially a write, and get is essentially a read, both from a file. But there's no equivalent of open, no equivalent of close. And in fact, whenever you do that request, when you say get a URL, you don't normally say, although there is support for partial things, you say, I want the whole page. So it's the equivalent of, I want to read the entire file, send the entire file to me. And when I want to write, I write an entire file to the server. Here you go. Here's the whole contents. HTTP is stateless in its original incarnation. And that's one of the key reasons why web servers can scale up. But, of course, what are modern web apps doing? They have lots of state. You want to read your email? When you read your email, the server has to know, oh, you're accessing your email, you started your client, you logged in. It has to remember that. You're maintaining state on the server that it knows that you're logged in. What happens when you log into, say, your Gmail account on two computers and make changes to your files on one computer and look at them from the other one? What changes to your email on one computer and look at it from another computer? Do you see the changes immediately? No.
It's not completely consistent. In particular, the cache is not completely consistent.
Each web browser is maintaining a cache of your email messages. It actually prefetches them. That cache is maintained locally to minimize latency. So that means that when you scroll through your email, you don't sit there having to wait for each message to load. It's already been loaded. It's already sitting there. You can quickly access it. But in order to make that caching work right, it can't be constantly talking with the server, because then you'd be waiting for the server every time you accessed an email message, and it would be laggy. So the price for lack of lagginess is less consistency,
less coordination. It's the same thing. That's what the reason why I'm bringing this here is not so much I want to test you directly on it, but to realize you see this behavior all the time. You are dealing with things on a regular basis that are kind of like network file systems, but they're not exactly network file systems because the strict file system semantics have been thrown away. Instead, specialized semantics are there for the particular application. You go back a couple of decades, it was thought it was a really good idea just to try to export a file system on the network and have it
just treat it as the same thing. But that's not, we realize that's not a good idea.
Now, something in between NFS and the current state of the web is this thing called AFS. If you want to learn about all the details of AFS, you can read the AFS chapter. It actually has some really cool security stuff. So one thing NFS is sometimes called is no-file security. And that's because how do you know what the user... So when you open a file on the server, you have to specify the user ID of the file. You know, what is your user ID? So the server can check whether you have permission. How does the server know you have the right user ID? It doesn't. It trusts the client to say, oh, your user ID, 4742? Sure. Okay. So in other words, when you mount an NFS file share, the computer mounting it can access any file in it. File permissions essentially are meaningless at that level. So I take my let me put it this way. I take my laptop. I say, could I NFS mount, the server? Let's say it's a faculty server. Okay. I talk to the SCS people. Like, oh, you have an NFS server. Can I bring in my laptop? Can I mount the share that has all the faculty accounts? They say, oh, sure. The moment I do that, I can access everyone's file, every file in that thing. They say, but can't you just access yours? My user ID? I control the laptop. I can do whatever I want on it. I can access it whatever user ID I want. I just tell it to send that, and it gets every file. So that's why if you see NFS being used in a system, regular users do not have administrative access on the clients. In the SCS setup, the Lambda machines, the Zeta machines and stuff, when you access those machines, they NFS mount from an NFS file server. That's how your student accounts are there. You can't take your Linux box and access those shares. Not directly. Because if you could, you could bypass all the file security and access all the files of every student. So, funny design. Not necessarily that. AFS gets around this. It's got this whole authentication mechanism called Kerberos. It's really got a cool design. It's neat. But for the purposes here, I'm more interested in the caching issue. So NFS, when AFS came out, NFS was stateless. They realized for increased scalability, they actually needed the protocol to be stateful because they wanted to enable good client-side caching. So with AFS, when you open a file, it's kind of like an HTTP GET. You just grab the entire file. All reads and writes occur locally on the workstation. When do they get written back? You close the file. So that works perfectly fine. Now the server has to be stateful because, of course, it has to, in order to know, oh, someone else is accessing your file, I have to be able to push updates and stuff. But there's a really weird way we've messed up file semantics now. Subtle, but devastating. You want to see what it is? When do the writes actually go to the file server? On close. What if the network is disconnected when you close the file? All your changes are lost. Nothing has been written to the file server. So if you're a program that's running, say it's a word processing program. You're editing a file, you're writing along, you're running, you type it all in, and then you save, and then you quit the program. You save, close the file, and then you quit. What happens if the close failed? You wrote nothing. How often, all the reads and writes would have succeeded.
you would have written successfully everything out to the file. The only thing that fails in AFS when you get disconnected from the server is the close. When you've written your programs, how often have you checked the return value of close? Because you expect close to fail all the time, right? No. Close, normally, you just put in a close just to put in a close. Or you forget to put in a close because your process is going to terminate and you just let it. No, do whatever. You're not checking the return value of close because normally close just works. But not in an AFS basis. In AFS, the writes kept going to the file system. It didn't do nearly as aggressive caching, so it kept going to the server, so you wouldn't lose things like that. But with AFS, things could fail rather catastrophically when the program had no idea. You had to make a program AFS aware. You didn't have to change the main part of the code. It's all fine. But now, anytime it's dealing with closing files, you have to check error states and do something like retry close. Because close, in fact, is a commit. It's like a database commit.
Why can't the file system do that?
So it can do, you can retry it potentially for float. Well, there's a couple of ways of doing it. So one way to do it is to make close fail, like it's return error without. Another way to do it is make close block. Is that better? I mean, now you do a close and all of a sudden your system, your program freezes. Do you normally expect close to take a long time? To never return? Because that could, what could happen? It could literally never return because it's still busy, you know, retrying. I mean, either way, the semantics are bizarre. Normally, when the server comes back up, you can do the close and it will write to it. Because normally the servers remember their state and things. But yeah, you better hope no one wrote to it while you were away. Then it gets all kind of weird. AFS is not really good for a disconnected operation. It really doesn't work well. There are successors to it called CODA and other things that try to make disconnected operation work. But the end result of trying to make disconnected file systems work is things like Dropbox, to maintain complete local copies and stuff. It batches them up sometimes. It doesn't necessarily do like each little thing, but it'll like send them in bursts. It keeps writing continuously. Exactly. And it does it upon close because that means that every access to the file happens in a local copy, which means it runs as fast as a local machine. It's accessing a remote file, then it's just as fast as accessing a local file, which is really nice. Because otherwise, you have this thing where you have lots of other computers accessing file system. The more you have, normally an NFS server will get slower and slower and slower. With AFS, it often wouldn't happen. There are limits also, but it could scale much to many more clients because they did such aggressive caching. But if your programs were not AFS aware, and of course they had to be AFS aware in this really weird way. They were aware of it because they handled close carefully. This is what happens when you go trying to use an API. This is a basic rule for API reuse. When you take an API that was designed for one circumstance and you use it in another circumstance, unless that circumstance really is the same, you end up taking that API and twisting it all around until it becomes very strange. And that is the problem with treating everything as a file. Sometimes it's really not going to obey file semantics. Yeah, I've run a little over for my first half. I will pause now, and so it's 9:25. We'll pause till 9:30. Okay, let's go ahead and get started again.
So.
So the so one thing I forgot to mention about locks. So when you're in memory and you lock some data structure using a semaphore or something, can you get around the lock? If you want to just be perverse or something and say, oh, it's locked. Oh, I'm going to ignore the lock and I want to access the data structure anyway. Can you do it? Trivially, right? That's the whole problem with using locks. If you don't use them consistently, you accidentally mess with the data structure and interrupt everything. So you have to be very disciplined when using locks, especially in languages like C, because before you access that data structure, grab the lock. When you're done accessing the data structure, release the lock. Don't do that properly, everything gets corrupted. So what that means is that style of locking, where it's essentially everyone just sort of cooperating and trying to behave properly, is known as advisory locks. They're just advice. If you want your program not to crash and burn, you really probably want to follow this lock and listen to what it said. Oh, that data structure being used, it really is being used. When you get to file systems and you start locking files rather than locking data structures in memory, the locks are instead, what can be advisory. In Unix, by default, all file system locks are advisory. So you can lock a file, and then you can unlock a file, and it will still be, you can lock a file, and you can still do things with it, unless you're paying attention to it. So like the classic example of this is for email. Email would normally be written to a spool file. So it would be var mail or var spool mail, and then your username. And it would be one file, and every email message you get would be appended to the end of the mail spool. But now, of course, you want to read your email and maybe delete email. So you're accessing this file that is getting written to by the mail server, and you're using a mail client, which is going to make changes to it. Concurrent access to the same file. This should sound dangerous. It is. So classically in a Unix system, you would want to lock that file. So you know what the classic way of locking that file is? It's kind of fun. No. You don't want to do that. You create a second file with the extension .log. So my mail spool might be var mail soma. And so whenever I access it with one program, it would create a file var mail soma .log. That's a lock file. If that's there, other programs should look at it and go like, oh no, someone's accessing the mail spool. I better not do anything with it. And they wait until the lock file goes away. What if they forget to delete the lock file? And goes, oh no, I can't access the lock. I can't access your mail. And they just treat it as if it's busy and have to do something else with it. And then once you remove it, it goes like, oh, I can now write my email. So, could you access your mail when that other file was there? Yeah. You could still read it. You could still do whatever you want. You could still delete it. It was just a convention that was used by various mail reading programs. They know when you access a user's mail spool file, better check that .lock file, because if you don't check for it properly, bad things can happen. Want to have a case where a lot of people lost mail? Put your mail spool on NFS. It turns out that's actually why they use the .lock file. It was basically the best way to do it over NFS, because now you have this little zero length file being created and destroyed and stuff. But even so, every so often, things would blow up. This is actually why you have protocols like POP and IMAP. Was before, the way you would access email was, oh, I want to have email access in my distributed network with all my Unix workstations. I'll just export the mail spool and let all the workstation access it. And eventually enough people lost enough email. They said, that's a really bad idea. And so they made mail servers, which actually had specialized protocols for doing this. But there are mandatory locks in file systems, and that's what Windows does on their local files. When a file is in use, it has a mandatory lock on it because it's being accessed. Anytime you access a file, you, in effect, have a kind of mandatory lock on it. And you can't get rid of it. Which, again, I just explained why that's the case, but it's really annoying. So the whole point of me explaining this, other than if you cover this material, is also so you can do the last tutorial and assignment, which you're prepared for this afternoon. And in that assignment, you are going to be using something called SSHFS. Based on the name, you probably know what this does. It's a file system over SSH. So secure shell. So what's SSH normally used for? Used for remotely logging into computers. Also, there are things like SFTP and SCP that use the same basic protocols for transferring files. So what SSHFS is, it takes the SSH protocol, the SFTP, and then uses that to implement a file system. So any computer that you would SSH to and access the files, you can use SSHFS to mount it and access those files locally. So you're in your virtual machine, in your things, and you want to access those files on your SCS account, where you normally have to copy them back and forth. You can just use SSHFS mounted on some directory called SCS. And now all of a sudden, all the files in your SCS account are available. You can CD there, you can open them up in a regular work. You just access them as if they were local. With a, you know, a slight performance penalty, but they're all there. Kind of cool, huh? So it works pretty well in most cases. The point of this lab is for you to get an understanding of what the heck is happening here. So this is implemented using Fuse. So this is another Fuse file system. It's a Fuse file system. It's also a network file system. I was going to have you all play with NFS. I started trying to get NFS working in the virtual machines. And it got annoying enough. I was like, I know I've gotten NFS working too many times in my life. I know I can get this working, but if it was more painful than I wanted to expose you all to. And this just works. And it covers all the things I wanted to teach you. So we'll go with SSHFS. And it's actually useful to boot. Like, you're not going to be doing NFS mounts most of the time, but you might want to use this to access stuff. This is, like, for example, let's say you're maintaining a website. You have to now copy the files to the website and stuff like that. Or you say, like, wouldn't it be nice if I could just edit those files locally? I don't want to copy the whole website down to my system. SSHFS it. Mount it locally. Now you can just, it's like they're all there. You can just edit them in any editor. Do what you want, save them, and they're now stored on the server. No need to synchronize back and forth. No need to even maintain a local copy. So in that way, it's better than things like Dropbox, because let's say your local hard disk is kind of small and the remote hard disk is kind of big. Now you have access to a whole world of files. They're all remote. You just need an SSH account. So, genuinely useful. I don't think it supports Windows. Well, no, I take that back. There is Fuse implementations for Windows. I think there's some way of getting this there, but you might need Cygwin to make it work on Windows. But I know but this sort of things definitely do work on Mac OS. It's pretty well supported on Mac OS. It's Unix. So how do you think you would make something like this work? What sort of architecture would you have for something like this?
You're going to SSH to a computer, and you're going to want it to look like a local file system. What do you need to have happen when you mount? So I mount a file system over SSH. So your account, the SCS servers, is now going to be mounted in directory SCS in your student account. Caching. So do you think there should be some caching? It certainly would potentially help with performance. How much caching depends on definitely how they built it. But first off, before we go there, let's talk about how is this going to work? How do you, what is it when you mount this file system, what's going to have to be created? What happened when you created a mounted a file system using the other few things? Was there something that was running? You had to have a process that was constantly running while the file system was mounted. And when that process was killed, the file system went away. It might have still thought it was mounted in a weird state, but it wouldn't work. You had to have a process running, a server process in effect. File system server process running locally.
So, a little more loud. We'll call it Cmax. And then we've got the kernel. This is the SSH server. There's two kernels. We establish a network connection over TCP/IP between these. What's running over here? On the server. I've got to have a process here. I've got SSHD running. So now I want to make it so that the files that I can access in my account here will be visible over here. What do I need? What process is doing? Is Emacs going to talk to the SSHD process? Not direct, not at all. What's it instead going to talk to? Will Emacs know about this SSH process? It will have no knowledge of it whatsoever. It will be doing system calls to the kernel, doing open, read, write, close, whatever file operations. It just so happens when the file system it accesses is a fuse mounted file system associated with SSHFS, you know the process. And so that process, so there's the SSHFS. It is fused. This is a fuse-based file system. The file system, when I say fuse-based, I mean it's a file system in user space. But it's a more complicated case because now we have this SSHFS here. SSHFS, your requests from here are going to go here. And those requests, of course, have to go over here. Now, when you mount it, what's going to have to happen? You're going to have to log in, right? This has got to be a successful login. Yeah. version number two. So the idea is that when you connect to an SSH server, every time you connect, it creates a new process. And that new process is the one that actually takes care of the communication. It actually creates a couple of processes. It does something for the security, but... It's when it happens, it'll still be called SSHD. But actually, I take that back. Modern SSH is a number of processes, so I'm forget exactly what they'll call it. No, it actually says SSHD, and then it says pseudo TTY talking on or something. I've checked that. One of the cases, you do the initial connection to this one. It will fork off another process. And that process will be the one that actually handles communication. Now, here's something in terms of code reuse. Do you think this talks directly to SSH FS? Well, no, what I'm talking about is, do you think they implemented all of SSH in it?
Why? Probably have. I need to check this before you do the lab.
But I know it does in SSH. It has a separate SSH process to start. So the initial connection here would go to this. This would create, and then this would create the child, and then now these two have this connection here. And SSHFS have a pipe open here to talk to this. These are logically two separate things. In principle, this can be incorporated into this. But since it already exists as a nice thing, why we implement it, we just talk to it. And it's going to talk to the SSH protocol. All this has to do is now figure out how to map this to file system standards. Yes, they would. Actually, that is true. Because they're really getting here. That's really going like this. Because they're network connections. Oh, basically all IO goes to the kernel. The only time we can get around that is if you do some shared memory. And then you can maybe do some I/O through that, but if you do shared memory, the kernel is involved. So, I'm kind of just putting this picture up and getting you to think about this because it's really what you did last week, the last lab and things, but it's just more elaborate because it's not just on one computer. It's now got another computer in the picture, and there's other processes involved. And the big problem with other processes being involved is it's more ways for things to break. Wait, which one are you talking about? The server or the new process on the client or the new process on the server?
You have that.
It could do that, but the trouble is then what you have to do is implement the entire SSH protocol in here. And it turns out we already have a perfectly good program for handling SSH traffic, SSH traffic. And that, the classic Unix way of doing these things is if you have a self-contained program that fulfills a certain functionality, just use it. Sometimes that function I get turned into a library that gets linked in. But it's an easier way of doing encapsulation by doing this, especially if you're doing communication, which is basically a pipe. I don't know if it's better. I think this is simpler.
Is SSH the most secure protocol?
I wouldn't say the most. I would say it's certainly one of the better secure protocols. When you say the best,
that might be an interesting little competition. You know what it is. I mean, the main thing about SSH, so the two main protocols that are used for encrypting like TCP/IP stuff is SSH and HTTPS or SSL. SSL and HTTP, SSL or TLS, I'm trying to throw out all these acronyms. So the originally secure sockets layer was SSL. Then they realized they wanted to use it for more than just sockets. So they changed the name from SSL to TLS for transport layer security. Turns out SSL stopped with one version, and which actually now is broken. And so now you should just be using TLS, which is the new version. So there's TLS, and then there's SSH. And to a first approximation, it would seem that SSH and TLS do the same thing. The fact is SSH is a much more feature-rich protocol because SSH is designed to replicate a shell interaction. So it has all these things for terminals, it has things for file transfers, it has all these sort of stuff. TLS is just supposed to turn a TCP connection into a secure TCP. But as far as which that works, sure. Maybe TLS is better because it's a simple protocol. I don't know. Anyway, this is good because, so one also nice thing about this, having set up this way, is what happens if this or this mess up? If they hang or get confused or something. Just kill them. This thing can kill them and restart them.
Now, one thing I think I have to get working for the lab
is that when you do this SSH in, if you want this to be able to restart the connection, do you want it to remember your password? In general, you want this to do the sort of connection without using a password, using something called an SSH agent. Have you all heard of SSH agents? You'll see it. But the idea is it's something that will help you do all this without having to type in your password. So, enjoy the tutorial, enjoy the last assignment. I'm going to try keeping it not too hard, but useful, so hopefully it's a little fun. And next week, we will spend our time talking about solutions.